Tottenham story is this. It's time to change the situation if Tottenham want to change.
I love to win, mate. That's the main thing. Hopefully I can fulfil those dreams and aspirations of every Tottenham supporter.
And still Ricky Villa. What a fantastic run. He scored.
He's going to have a crack. He is, you know. Oh!
I'm loving big engines instead. Guess I'm a Spurs fan now then.
Welcome along to our latest offering from the Tottenham Way podcast. I'm Marcus Buckland, alongside the two Toms, Barkley of the Sun and Allnut of the Times, and the Evening Standard's football correspondent, Dan Kilpatrick. Now, I've just about got my voice back after that comeback against Crystal Palace. Particular thanks to the two gentlemen I sat next to, having, I thought, very magnanimously given up my seat to a young lady who travelled from Germany with her partner. They had separate seats, but I stepped in and said, you can have mine. So I sat with a couple of other people who were great fun but loud and insisted that I chant the whole way through. So apologies if I'm a little bit croaky. Thank God there was lots to shout about in the closing minutes. And of course, next up, Aston Villa away. Massive game for both sides on Sunday. I've done the calculations in terms of remaining fixtures. Whether that's good news or bad news, I'll keep you on tenterhooks. But Dan, let's start with you because the two Toms gave us a terrific immediate reaction to the Palace game. And I concurred wholeheartedly with them. After about 75 minutes, it did look to me as though the Postecoglou honeymoon period was about to come to an end. And then, lo and behold, Johnson comes on, Timo Werner remembers how to score, and within 15 minutes it had felt like a really good afternoon at Tottenham. What was your summary?
Very magnanimous of you to give up your seat to a German lady. Well done, you.
She was very attractive.
There we go. Yeah, I thought that the two Toms did a great job on the reaction pod. I'd encourage people to listen to that for take on the Villa game, really. It's a different game if Werner scores in the first half, because Palace are a difficult team to break down. They always have been, and they've got that muscle memory from the Hodgson era. So it was a tough game for Spurs. I mean, my takeaway is that these comebacks, you know, aren't really sustainable. I mean, we saw that with the Wolves game, right, which looked like it was going a similar way to Bournemouth and Brentford and Saturday, but didn't. You know, Wolves have the quality to come back into it. And you, I think we might get onto Eze, but you kind of wonder, you know, what might have happened if Eze had been fit enough to do 90 minutes or if Elise had been fit. You know, would Spurs have been able to come, or indeed Mark Gay, you know, would Spurs have been able to come back into the game in the same way? Palace were missing a lot of their quality, and I think they understandably faded. They're kind of playing at a higher intensity under Glasner than they were under Hodgson, and they were working really hard. So a good win for Spurs in difficult circumstances, but they can't keep getting away with this at home, really. So, you know, they need to either be more clinical and you know, the Werner chance felt like a big moment, or get that spark back that the guys mentioned on the reaction pod, you know, get that zip, that spring in their step, that connectivity in the final third, which all feels like it's been missing for a few months now. I mean, really, as entertaining as it was on Saturday, you know, you probably have to go back to Newcastle in mid-December for a really convincing performance from Spurs, and that's a concern. But, you know, like a win's a win.
Just one thing to add on it that's emerged since the game. Spurs actually broke their own Premier League record for number of passes in that game. I think it was something like 732. I can't say when I was watching the game. I mean, obviously they were dominating possession. That was obvious. Way Palace's setup was always going to happen. But I suppose my question is kind of, how much does that really matter? I mean, it sounds pretty good. And it was their 38th game in a row league game that they'd scored, which is, I think, probably more of a encouraging, exciting, impressive stat that's sort of reflective of the Postecoglou era. But yeah, I mean, what do you reckon, Dan? Sounds like you've got an opinion on that.
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder how Postecoglou would feel about that, because I was having a look at this seminar he did, this kind of YouTube show a few years ago last week, and he was talking about the sort of cornerstones of his philosophy in a lot of detail. And one thing he kept repeating was that he doesn't like possession for the sake of possession. You know, it's got to be possession with the aim of kind of hurting the opponent. And I guess that does sort of set him apart from, you know, Guardiola and Arteta maybe. You know, he's not that interested in control. You know, he wants the possession to be you know, about hurting the opponent and basically scoring and making chances. And I think one of you guys touched on it, you know, the sort of slightly tippy-tappy nature of Saturday on the reaction pod. And I think probably there was a lot of possession, kind of for the sake of possession at times, just Spurs moving it round in front of Palace's 11. And you imagine that Postecoglou would be a bit frustrated by that and want to see a bit more sort of penetration and risk-taking and the sort of zip and spark and all the things you guys touched on.
There's two things that I'd like to touch upon. First of all, I just want to say well done to Emerson Royale, who I was very critical of after the Wolves game, and I think rightly so. But it was tough for him because he came into that difficult match, you know, occupying a role that Pedro Porro has started to excel in. And it does bring a lot of questions, I think, for players. And he struggled that day, but he played again on Saturday. I thought he was brave, industrious. He's not afraid to try clever little flicks, do what he feels is the right thing to do, even if it's quite a dangerous thing to do at times. And I know that when he had that big break and an opportunity to cross for Son, he didn't get it right. But I just thought fair play to Emerson Royal. And the other thing I'd like to ask all of you about is Ange's substitutions, because I'm still a little concerned. And notably at the weekend, we went 2-1 up and he immediately took off Maddison and I think Werner as well. And my mind and the mind of several of the people around me immediately went back to the Everton game where he did the same thing. We were 2-1 up and then we looked to defend and Everton equalised in the last minute. Am I right to just question some of the great man's tactics at times? Tomé, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I mean, I remember this at this kind of start of the season, even when they were playing really well, he was taking off Son and Maddison. Do you remember? He did that quite a few times in a row, I think. And I remember asking Maddison about it in the mix zone after... Oh, you were there, Tom. I can't remember where it was now.
Luton? But they were down to 10 men then as well, to be fair.
Might have been Luton away. You might be right, yeah. And I sort of said to him, you know, this thing with him taking you and Sonny off, you know, what's the deal? And Maddison sort of said, oh, you know, you shouldn't read too much into it, you know, as long as we win the game sort of thing. But I sort of wonder if it's something to do with their fitness at the moment, which I guess, you know, Maddison's still coming off the back of an injury. Maybe you sort of think, does he think he's kind of ready for the sort of full 96 minutes or whatever? But the fact that he did it at the beginning of the season as well makes me think that it's a tactical thing, you know, and it doesn't really square, does it, with the idea that we always think of Postecoglou as always kind of, you know, one more goal, you know, even when you're kind of 1-0 up sort of thing, you know, why is he taking off the kind of most attacking players? And I agree, it sort of reduces Tottenham's impetus, I think, because those players, they are attacking players, but in a way they're also defensive because they give Spurs a way out, you know, and someone like Maddison is so good at keeping the ball kind of in tight areas and things. I agree. I mean, I have sort of wondered that all season about why he does that, and maybe it's something we could ask him at the next press conference.
To be fair to Postecoglou, I'm going to disagree with you guys. He took off Maddison and Werner on 82 minutes when Spurs were already 2-1 up and they ended up winning 3-1. And the only player he brought on when they were behind was Johnson, who turned the game. So I think you can make a pretty compelling case that he got his substitutions absolutely bang on and they were decisive in a positive way on Saturday.
I agree completely.
I think, I mean, you can't argue with that with Johnson. I mean, Johnson was obviously completely instrumental and I mean, he has been now for two or three games. But I sort of think you can't just take it one game. I mean, in this instance, it worked. You can't argue with that. But there have been other examples this season. We've talked before about how Spurs are basically the most exciting team in injury time. You know, they either score goals or they concede them. You know, it can go either way. And I guess, you know, do you think that's because, you know, the substitutions are good or not? I mean, I personally, and wrote about this a couple of weeks ago, I personally think it's often because Ange kind of rolls the dice. You know, he sort of keeps the team kind of open and trying to score. And as a result, yeah, they either make it 3-1 or they make it 2-2. You know, and we've seen this before where it feels like the game can kind of swing either way in that last 10 minutes where perhaps previous coaches, other coaches would maybe settle or just keep what they have.
This sort of question over his substitutions mainly cropped up after that Everton game where they did seem to lose control and it was totally just legitimate criticism at the time. And it's more been since then, keeping a keen eye on what he does. But I agree with Dan in this particular game. I do think he got them spot on. It's not just the fact that he brought Johnson on and we talked a lot about on the Reaction podcast about how he seems to be flourishing, not having to play every minute and the pressure that comes with that. But it's the fact that he took Bentancur off for Johnson. That was a tactical switch. And we can talk about Bentancur in a bit about how he sort of really fits into this. But that was a bold move. I mean, he could have instead gone for Werner maybe or one of the attacking players. So I think that was impressive. Just on to the Maddison question. It is interesting because on the one hand, I think anyone could understand with Maddison's injury record that they might be taking that he might be taking precautions with him, and that's why he often comes off. But the one sort of caveat to that is whenever we ask him about, you know, whether Maddison will be fit for this game, is he going to be ready? He often is like, he's quite bullish in his answers, and he's sort of like, well, you know, he better be. That's kind of what's going to happen when he plays all these games in Europe next year, and that's what it's like at the top level. So it kind of is slightly at odds with what he's actually doing by protecting him, taking him off. Not saying that I think that's a bad idea. I think, as I said, with his injury record, that's probably quite a sensible way of going about things. But I don't know, sometimes with injuries, as we know, it's a bit of a grey area with Ange.
Yeah, and I think, Dan, you're right to say that, of course, with the benefit of hindsight, he got those substitutions right on Saturday. I just think, you know, going forward on a regular basis, as a fan, I want to see Spurs being as proactive as possible when they're in front, looking to go from 2-1 to 3-1, rather than sitting back just a little bit. No, it worked at the weekend, fair enough, and your best friend Højbjerg came on and did what he has to do. And that very interesting set about 732 passes that Spurs made at the weekend. Well, I reckon 596 of those were a bit of a waste of time, to be honest. But, you know, stats, damn stats, substitutions, all the rest of it, Spurs won, fair enough. I do want to talk about Eze because, again, I think you boys, the two Toms, were spot on. Somebody like Eze next season and Neto as well. In fact, it's obvious. Let's buy now. Well, let's make the bids. Eze, Neto, and Elise. Let's really screw up Crystal Palace because, come on, they stunk the place out. I know there was nothing else that they could really do. But if every team, and I know the argument, you look at Sheffield United, who, if they were, I don't know what they were trying to do against Arsenal, but if you try to match up to sides that are much better than you, you do lose 6-0 at home. But watching Manchester United at Manchester City at the weekend, everyone goes, oh, well, it's the right thing to do because had they been a bit more adventurous, they'd have lost 6-1. But bloody hell, it does get a bit boring, don't you think? And I feel a bit for Spurs. No wonder we had to make 732 passes because these teams are just camping with Mateta. I mean, God knows what Mateta was doing. I thought one of the funniest things of the afternoon was watching Mateta try and get the ball under pressure from Van de Ven. Waste of time, mate. He's five times quicker than you. What are you doing on the pitch? But it was a bit dull. But Eze, to me, when he's fit, looks to be an obvious answer. Danny Boy, would you agree? Eze, Neto plus one, and Spurs can win the league next season.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Eze sort of ties together these two sections quite nicely because the other thing to say about substitutions is that Palace faded when he went off. And I do think that was a factor. You know, when he's on the pitch, you always kind of know he can hurt you. And obviously he won the free kick and scored it. And I felt that, as you said, Mateta wasn't getting much joy. He was kind of up there by himself against Van de Ven and losing every sort of 50-50 duel. And so Palace kind of lost their hard edge when Eze went off. And I think that emboldened Spurs to, you know, push up a few yards and get the goals they did. Yeah, I mean, I think Eze's a... He seems like a really nice guy as well, just like a lovely human. So I think he'd definitely be a great signing. But it's clear that Spurs sort of need a winger who can beat a man and deliver a final ball as well. I mean, I don't know if we need to go over Timo Werner again. I think the jury's obviously still out on him. But a sort of dribbly winger with end product just seems to me to be the top priority net now for Spurs. That they're clearly kind of lacking in that area, and they're going to face this kind of approach a lot more. I mean, I know you say it's dull, but you know it can be really effective, and you know we've seen that time and again. And the more Spurs improve under Postecoglou, the more sides are going to come to North London in particular and set up that way. So Spurs have to have answers to that, and I think a winger who can, you know, just consistently win foot races and beat his man is a kind of big step toward breaking down this type of side. And we've seen Werner do a bit of it, but the final ball hasn't always been there. Johnson's looking like, you know, he's starting to add some end products. So there are encouraging signs, but Spurs are short in that area.
It was interesting to me that Eze and his entourage had basically a full box to themselves at Tottenham. I don't know if that's entirely normal for a kind of opposition player to have a whole suite of their friends and family and presumably a couple of agents. I know that Eze belongs to belongs to Bayes, who are very agency, very connected with Spurs. But I did wonder if there was a bit of wooing going on there. I wonder if they kind of gave Eze and his pack, you know, a very nice kind of day out at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. I don't know. Maybe that's just me, you know, just pontificating.
You sort of touched on it there. He is a Bayes client, and that box belongs to Bayes, I think. So that was part of the reason. Obviously, they've got a lot of clients at Tottenham, including the manager. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the dots connect quite like that, just because they have got other players and the manager that he'll end up at Spurs. But as I said on the reaction pod, I think he'd be a great sign.
You underestimate, Tom, the power of the cheese bar, you know, the power of the Tottenham Hotspur corporate hospitality.
Go on, sandwich brigade, yeah.
Well, I did notice as well at the final whistle, I mean, all the players mingling around chatting on the pitch, but there was a lot of friendly banter between Eze and two or three of the Spurs players, including Sonny. So, yeah, I think you may have just struck a bit of a chord there. We will find out. In the summer, of course. Now, just before we move on to this Villa game, we've spoken already today about how sometimes when we're not sure about injuries at Tottenham, we get mixed messages. Can anybody tell me what's going on with Richarlison? And for that matter, Perisic, who I believe was on the bench at the weekend. This is the man who we were told a few months ago was not going to play again this season. It's one of the reasons he was allowed to leave. And, OK, we have made the point that perhaps the Croatian League is not as tough physically and you might be able to start back a little earlier. But what, first weekend in March? So please, somebody, explain what is going on with Richarlison. Tom B, I think you've got your ear to the ground. And also whether we've made a bit of an error by allowing Perisic to leave so early.
Yeah, injuries seem to be something that we've discussed a lot for obvious reasons. They just had a lot of them. And players coming back at times when we weren't expecting them to. Start off with Perisic. Yeah, it was surprising. He was back on the bench this weekend. So I think I read the manager there said he was an unused substitute, but the manager said the Perisic wanted to be involved. But if he's on the bench already, it suggests that it's not too far away. Obviously, his main goal seems to be getting back for Croatia and the Euros in the summer. But yeah, we're at the start of March. And given how good he was coming off the bench for Tottenham at the start of the season, what a different option he offered. If he is up to speed in a month's time, and yes, you're totally right, the Premier League is so different to the Croatian League. So maybe that it's irrelevant how if he's flying in the Croatian League in a month's time, he just wouldn't be the same. But you know, I think if that turns out to be the case, I do think you could rightfully sort of question that decision. Do you want to talk about it, Dan, before we move on to Richarlison? Sounds like you want to jump in there.
I just wanted to jump in to say I just had a quick look at the Ange quote where he says Perisic won't play for Spurs again. It was unlikely to play for Spurs again this season. He doesn't actually say it's because of injury. I know that's I know that might be a bit cheeky for Ange, but I just wonder whether they... It was my question, and it was, when was it?
Your question was, like, will he play for Spurs again? Rather than will he play this again this season? So it's like, but I mean, I feel like are we sort of, and this may be the same thing that I'm about to do with Richarlison, we're sort of going, well, you know, if you read it this way, then actually it kind of works, but I seem to be doing that quite a lot this year. Regarding Richarlison, so he picked up a knee injury, I believe, in the Wolves game, which was obviously over a fortnight ago. In the press conference ahead of Palace game on the Friday, Ange said 3 to 4 weeks. He had also spoken to in-house media saying 2 to 3 weeks. That instantly got a bit of confusion on that one. Then Richarlison gets called up for the Brazil squad, which has been announced already, for the internationals later this month, of which one of them is at Wembley playing against England. The manager, albeit obviously it's in Portuguese, so how it gets translated exactly, whether it's spot on into English, I'm not sure, but it suggested it would just be one game he'd be out for, i.e. the Crystal Palace game, and he'd be fine for the internationals. So we then asked it, I think Matt Barlow of the Mail asked Ange to sort of clarify it in the post-match press conference after Crystal Palace. And Ange sort of said, look, I'm not trying to sort of be tricky, I think was the word he's saying. He was just saying, look, it's very simple. We think it's going to be this amount of time. So based on his time frame, 3 to 4 weeks, it was a week ago. He could be back in a couple of weeks. And basically what will happen is if Brazil will call him up, he'll go to international duty and they'll deem whether he is ready or not. And either he'll go with them or come back. And then Richarlison then spoke to ESPN in the mix zone and sort of declared himself that he would only be missing this Palace game and should be back ready for the Villa game at the weekend, which obviously would be a huge boost for Spurs, but is kind of confusing with the rest of the timeline. But I mean, that could just be a classic case of all players want to think they want to get back soon. You know, with Lo Celso this year, I've heard that he's, you know, back for a game because that's what he thinks he's going to be. And then it turns out he isn't, because just because a player wants to play, it doesn't necessarily mean that's actually what's going to happen. So it might be, well be a case of that. And I don't think it necessarily needs to be anything sort of suggestions of anything underhand from Postecoglou in terms of injuries. But it is fair to say we've had this crop up a few times this season.
I think two things can be true at once. And one is that Postecoglou tends to be pessimistic about injuries. We've seen that over and over again. And the other thing is that national teams often tend to be optimistic and kind of want their players to be fit for obvious reasons, which I think we're seeing here. So I think it's probably, rather than anything particularly sinister, I think it's probably a combination of those two things. You know, Postecoglou is working toward the top end of the timeline. Richarlison and Brazil are working toward, you know, the very, very best case scenario. And it's caused a little bit of confusion and a bit of back and forth.
Well, obviously, we hope he's back sooner rather than later. And if he was an option for the weekend at Aston Villa, then so much the better, because this is a huge game. And I know we're going to talk in a moment about, you know, whether fifth place will be good enough. And if it is, with Manchester United slipping out, then Spurs obviously are in an excellent position to qualify for the Champions League. Dan won't like it because he's not a fan of predictions, but I quickly had a look at the respective games for the two teams between now and the end of the season. And I'll just quickly rattle through. Villa, obviously, Spurs at the weekend. I'm tipping a draw in that one, so a point apiece. And then after that, they go to West Ham. I think they'll win. They have Wolves at home. I think they'll win that. Then they go to City, which they'll lose. They've got Brentford at home. They should win that. They'll go to Arsenal. I think they'll lose. Then Bournemouth at home, Chelsea at home, winnable matches. Brighton away, I think they get a point. Liverpool at home, I think they might be able to get a point. And they finish at Palace, and they'll pick up 3 points. And that gives them 21 more points. Now, bear in mind the fact that they're 5 points ahead of us at the moment, albeit Spurs have a game in hand. You know, Tottenham have got a tougher running. So if we do get the point at Villa, we then go to Fulham. I think we can win that, although Fulham are playing pretty well at the moment, so it won't be easy. We've got Luton at home. Well, that should be 3 points. West Ham away. Of course, the Hammers annoyingly always find their A game, but I think we can beat them. I know Dan wants to come in, but I'll quickly finish this because I've really worked it out to a fine detail. Forest at home, 3 points. Now, Newcastle away, I think we'll lose. I've got a bad feeling about that. City at home, point. Arsenal at home, point. Liverpool away, nothing. And then Burnley at home and Sheffield United away, 3 points in both of those games. It means that we'll pick up 21 points. Same as Villa. Based on this brilliant bit of analysis, we're not going to finish fourth. Over to you, Dan.
This is like that Premier League predictor game you used to be able to do on the BBC website, where you could kind of fill in 400 fixtures and work out where your team would finish. I just wanted to pick up, I'm just surprised you said you thought Spurs had the tougher run-in, because I also had a quick look at the fixtures, and Villa have 11 games left, 7 are against the top 10, and they've got the top 3 in there, obviously, and then 4 are against the bottom 10, but those 4 sides are Chelsea, who beat them in the Cup, Brentford, Bournemouth and Palace, who are obviously under new management. So 4 of the tougher sides in the bottom 10 for sure. And they've got none of the bottom 5. Spurs have 12 games left. 6 are against the bottom 10 and they play 4 of the bottom 5. 3 of those at home. So they've got Luton, Burnley and Nottingham Forest at home. and they've got Sheffield United away, which, frankly, looking at Sheffield United's home form, is a great game to have away. So I think on paper, Spurs have the much more favourable run in.
Yeah, I would agree with Dan. I have to say, I think I if you look at them both, they both got to play City, Arsenal, and Liverpool. But Villa have got to go to City and Arsenal away, whereas Spurs have got two of those at home. So okay, they're tough games, but Spurs have a minor advantage there. I think there are a couple of kind of middling teams. They both play West Ham away. They both play Newcastle and Chelsea. So, you know, over those kind of four or five games, they're basically the same, in my opinion. But the difference, I think, is that Spurs have then got, in theory, five very easy games in Fulham, Luton, Forest, Burnley and Sheffield United. Whereas Villa's other five are the kind of all the awkward teams in the Premier League. Brighton, Bournemouth, Brentford, Wolves and Palace, which are basically, I think, the kind of five teams that you kind of don't really want to play. Okay, they're not the kind of top six teams, but they're not the gimmies either. Those are all the kind of like banana skins. You know, we've seen what Wolves do against good teams, Brentford as well. They've got to go away to Brighton. So I would look at those five for Villa and really think, actually, they're difficult games. And I don't know when they land, particularly after Villa's European games, for example. I agree with Dan. I think Spurs have definitely got the edge in terms of the running, not only in the fact that they have City and Arsenal at home, but also in the fact that actually those sort of five easier games are much easier for Spurs than they are for Villa.
Well, I just have realised that in my brilliant analysis, I'd forgotten that we do have that rearranged game at Chelsea, which is critical because actually, yeah, if we do win that, I'm going to have to backtrack here very quickly. Dan, you're such an oracle. I don't know why I bothered even leading this conversation. Look, the bottom line is, because who knows what we'll do at Chelsea, it's very, very close. I don't think Spurs can afford to lose. I think we could all agree, really. I don't think Spurs can afford to lose at Villa at the weekend. Out of interest, guys, if you were to look at the respective starting 11s, who would come out on top in terms of representation? Villa at the weekend, their starting team at Luton was Martinez in goal, the man we don't really wish to refer to, the butcher Cash, Consa, Moreno, our old friend Clement Longley, Douglas Luiz, John McGinn, Leon Bailey, Ramsey, Tielemans and Ollie Watkins, who of course is in a very rich vein of form. How many of that Villa team gets into the Spurs starting 11?
I mean, not many, to be honest. I mean, it's a difficult one because I think Villa fans would probably pick out three or four of those at least and say they've been absolutely fantastic all season. And it's sort of the testament to the job that Unai Emery's done that you look at that team and you think, well, there aren't that many kind of superstars there, but they are getting the best out of players like John McGinn, who are just playing absolutely brilliantly. But as a, you know, from a Spurs side, you wouldn't take John McGinn in Tottenham's midfield. But I bet if you spoke to a lot of Villa fans, people would say, well, he's been absolutely fantastic all season. Same with Konsa. I mean, people probably wouldn't even put him in the same league as Romero, for example. But I know Villa supporters who say that Konsa has been basically one of their best players all season, you know. So, Douglas Luiz, I think, is for me the one sort of real outstanding player that could almost play for any team in the league. I could see him in Manchester City, for example. Ollie Watkins, there's an argument to say he's basically almost been Premier League player of the season, to be honest, up till now, you know. And you know, we're talking about kind of Harry Kane replacements, whatever, for England. Like, in my opinion, that debate is now over. I mean, the idea that Ivan Toney on current form is going to go to the Euros ahead of Watkins, no chance. So I guess those are the two real standouts. But equally, you know, Villa fans say that Emi Martinez has been absolutely superb as well. So I guess on first look, you would say not many. But I actually think on kind of form this season, you would probably take, I would take Watkins, Douglas Luiz, Konsa, possibly even Martinez, to be honest. Anyone else?
I wouldn't take Martinez over Vicario, but broadly agree. I mean, I think what Emery's done really well is make Villa more than the sum of their parts. They just seem to be a really well-functioning team. And I think one thing you could definitely say where Villa have the edge over Spurs is that, obviously, Emery's kind of 18 months into his project and he's further ahead. They feel like sort of more of a unit that where everyone knows their jobs and everyone's kind of clicking. And they just feel like a kind of more advanced project and team, I guess, than Spurs do, certainly in the last few weeks. And I think that they don't have as much individual quality as Spurs on paper. I think most neutrals would pick the Spurs squad and pick out most individuals in the Spurs squad, but I think Villa have that kind of unity and cohesiveness that isn't quite there for Postecoglou's Spurs yet. I mean, I think I'll let Tom B come in, but I think a sort of big factor in the run-in is just the number of games. You know, most of us look at Villa's Conference League commitments and think that's going to be a problem. They've got Ajax this week, and that's a big game. And Emery will want to win that. He's got a great record in Europe. He's not a manager who takes Europe lightly. He likes winning European trophies, and Villa should be the overwhelming favourites for that competition, just as kind of West Ham were, and just as pretty much every English team every year should be. But Postecoglou has suggested in his last press conference in pretty strong terms that he would like more games, and that Spurs' lack of fixtures is actually, he didn't say it was a disadvantage. He refused to say if it was an advantage or a disadvantage, but he's kind of implied that pretty strongly, that he thinks, you know, they would be better and have more rhythm and momentum with more games. So I guess it's interesting kind of how that dynamic plays out for the two sides.
Yeah, I was just going to mention those comments, and at first you sort of think, really? Surely having a bit of a easier schedule sort of fixture wise would help, but actually, when the more you think about it, the way Tottenham play and the intensity they play at, I can sort of see his point of view, and I don't really know how much of a advantage that is going to be over Villa. I do think if Villa win at the weekend, it's going to be a serious mountain for Spurs to get over. And I'm not sure I quite agree with Tom on the quality of the Villa players. I mean, I would have John McGinn. I'd have him over Pap Sarr or Bentancur alongside Maddison. I'd have Douglas Luiz as the holder. Ollie Watkins. I mean, one thing I would say about Villa is, and Ollie Watkins in particular, if he were to get injured, it would be such a huge blow for Villa. They wouldn't be able to replace him. I think there's, as we've seen this season with Tottenham, there are obviously certain players that they will struggle more without, but I think they can handle an injury to any player a lot better than Villa would with Ollie Watkins. So it's imperative that they keep him fit. And if he does somehow get injured, then I would definitely give Tottenham the upper hand. 16 league goals, 15 assists. It's incredible, really. What a player. I still think that even Tony could also get in the squad. I think there could be some manoeuvring to make that squad work. But Ollie Watkins surely has to go either way. And then, you know, I do love Destiny Adoghi, but I think Alex Moreno's also had a good season. I probably would pick Adoghi, but I think there's just a lot of players that there isn't really much between. I mean, Tielemans, I know he didn't play much at the start of the season, but he's now coming into it. We know what a good player he is. And then, as you say, the goalkeepers, I probably would give Vicario, but it's really a toss-up, and it's about those sort of the real special players. And I definitely have Watkins in the team, and maybe Luiz, that those two players might have really outshone everyone of Spurs. I don't know. It's hard, isn't it, with Maddison, because he's had so many injuries, but when he has been fit at the start of the season, he was electric, and obviously Van de Ven and Vicario have been fantastic. I mean, it's very close.
And just on Villa's squad, they've got quite a few long-term injuries, I think. I think Camara's had surgery, he's out for the season. Buendia and Mings haven't played at all. I think there might be one other. I think maybe Jacob Ramsey's injured at the moment as well. So
Ramsey played the last couple of games.
Right, okay. So, I mean, they've got a good squad. That they, you know, they, if they keep Emery, you know, that they're a rival for Spurs over the next few years, I think. There's a lot of quality there.
It seems like they might need European football more than Tottenham, though, from a financial point of view. I mean, do you remember, I think it was the last day of the window, suddenly there was talk of Jacob Ramsey and interest from Newcastle and Tottenham. And someone I watched a lot for the under-21s and has been a wonderful player, one of their best academy products to come through at Villa for a long time. And suddenly you're thinking, why would they possibly look to sell him? But obviously we know all about, you know, how much money you can make from a profit and sustainability regulations point of view from players who come through the academy, as Chelsea have sort of proven. So the fact that was even sort of floating around me, I was David Ornstein who broke that for The Athletic, and that would suggest that maybe they need to sort of balance some books going forward, whereas we all know what Tottenham's sort of situation is financially. So I don't know, that could just come into it over the coming years.
Well, Tom, it's interesting that you should mention the fact that Villa perhaps need Europe more. Now, on our running order, and I must say, I was a little surprised when I saw it, so I'll hand this over to you. But, and I will just mention three other names, by the way, who came on for Villa at the weekend, just to emphasise the point Dan's made about what a good squad of players they have, because Dinia came on and scored the winning goal. I like him as a player. Zaniola has a habit of doing significant things at key moments. Diaby also came off the bench. So they definitely got some options. Now, you know, fifth place might be enough to get in the Champions League. Which of the Toms has got a question mark about whether the Champions League is just a little overrated? Is that right? Well, have you gone mad?
I have a general feeling that a club shouldn't base their entire existence around finishing in the top four. And I do wonder if Tottenham have done this too much for the last, well, ever since they sort of qualified for the first time under Harry Redknapp. I feel like the be-all and end-all has simply been to be in the Champions League, get through the group stage and go out in the quarterfinals, you know? And, okay, the one asterisk here is that sensational run to the final under Pochettino, and no one can deny that has been one of the best moments in Tottenham's modern history. But all the rest has been, you know, fine. There have been some great moments, and I'm sure there are lots of fans who would say there have been some brilliant trips. And I understand that this is all part of the kind of, you know, the fabric of being a supporter. But in terms of the club and its kind of ambitions, I sort of have a suspicion that the kind of top four is a bit of a Sky Sports creation, basically aimed at keeping fans interested in the league when everyone knows it's going to be Manchester City or Liverpool who win it. And it's done a pretty good job of keeping clubs like Tottenham and Villa and Everton over the years kind of vaguely interested in the second half of the season. And I'm not denying that it has worth. There's no doubt about that. You know, it's an amazing competition, etc. And in terms of finances, it is pretty transformative, although it's worth saying that it's actually much less transformative than it used to be. There used to be, about 10 years ago, the idea that if you didn't finish in the Champions League, you couldn't sign top players. That's no longer the case, because the Premier League's wealth is so much now in comparison to the rest of Europe. It actually doesn't make that much difference. The top six or seven teams in the Premier League can now compete for almost all the best players in Europe. You know, and of course, there is a thing here with players personally saying, I want to play in the Champions League. That is true. But in terms of finances, the Premier League now has so much respect and prestige that actually the Champions League is no longer the kind of thing it used to be for attracting players. And just on a more kind of philosophical note, like, if Tottenham aren't going to win the Champions League, then I've said many times that I wish they would put more into winning the FA Cup and the League Cup and actually challenging for the title and this kind of thing, rather than just saying at this point in the season, are we going to beat Villa to get into fourth so that next year they are going to, you know, lose to Barcelona 5-0 and we're all going to be wondering if Postecoglou's style of play is the right thing. You know, this is not the end game for modern football. And yeah, I mean, I think it's a valuable thing, but I also think it's worth just kind of keeping in perspective.
I think just to follow on from that, because I agree with most of that, I remember thinking when Spurs beat Arsenal to the top four in Conte's first season in 21-22, with that big North London derby in May and Spurs getting over the line and Arsenal kind of crumbling. Yeah, I remember writing and kind of thinking, you know, this is a big moment in the kind of trajectory of the two clubs. You know, it feels like a bit of a zero-sum game in the race for fourth. You know, Spurs will be able to kick on. You know, they'll be in financially a stronger position. They'll be able to attract better players. There'll be more momentum behind the club. And then, you know, the following season, Arsenal go and, you know, nearly win the title, lead the pack for months and months, and Spurs really fall away. So which just goes to kind of illustrate Tom's point, really, that the Champions League, you know, doesn't kind of propel you to new heights, and it can help, but it's certainly not the be-all and end-all. I think that there is a real allure to it. I mean, I'm kind of intrigued to know how the new system will work, the Swiss model. I think there are going to be more big games and kind of more meaningful games next year, particularly for a side that kind of aren't guaranteed, you know, to be in the top pot like Spurs. I think the reasons UEFA are changing the model, to be clear, are because of the distorted financial landscape and because big clubs have kind of rigged the game. But that's not to say that the model itself won't kind of lead to a bit more tension and excitement. So, you know, obviously, I think it would be a great thing for Spurs to be in the Champions League. But I think broadly speaking, if they don't get there and, you know, they finish fifth and that's not enough, you know, which is a very plausible scenario, then I agree with Tom. I don't think it should kind of impact the club's trajectory, and it shouldn't really make a huge difference to the players they want to sign. I mean, having Premier League money and Premier League status and being in London are, you know, arguably kind of bigger factors than offering Champions League football, I think.
Terrific points, Tom. I mean, moments ago I'm suggesting you've gone mad. You have won me over with a brilliant argument. And yeah, I mean, you say go and try and win the FA Cup and the League Cup, absolutely. But also, I just wish that they marketed the Europa League a little better. Unfortunately, it's forever going to be tainted with all you're playing Thursday nights on Channel 5 and all the rest of it. If only they could bring in some marketing guru who could make the Europa League really sexy. I mean, even the Conference League. I mean, dear old West Ham, they're going to be dining off their success in that tournament for decades to come.
I have to say, I mean, I slightly disagree with you. I sort of feel like the Europa League, it used to be a joke. There was those sort of early days where Spurs played in the Europa League and it was just such a hassle Thursday night. No one wanted it. But I actually think in the last few years, there's an argument to say that it's actually become a really exciting competition, that almost more exciting even than the Champions League, because there are five or six teams who can win it. You get a lot of clubs, sort of those slightly kind of, I don't know, historically sort of prestigious, but no longer, teams like Benfica, Sporting Lisbon, Ajax, you know, and they're all in there. And I quite enjoy it. And I think the whole kind of winner gets into the Champions League thing has also sort of transformed it a bit. And there have been some big English clubs in there. Liverpool have been there a lot. You know, Man United have been there, Chelsea, you know. So it's, I think it's got a bit more gravitas because we've seen these kind of big giants playing in it.
Yeah, I would agree. But I just think because it comes after the Champions League each week, and it is a Thursday night, it doesn't have that gravitas that back in the very old days when you had the European Cup and the Cup Winners' Cup and the UEFA Cup, in many ways they were all on an equal level. I mean, if you won one of those, it was amazing. And now, whatever happens, it doesn't quite have that allure. And it's understandable because, of course, just by saying Champions League as opposed to Europa League, and the fact that if you win the Europa League, you go into the Champions League, it is an inferior competition to that regard. But I'd love Spurs. And the point I was going to make, and I agree with you, Tom, is that actually, what is the point of going into the Champions League if deep down you know you haven't got a chance of winning it, when if you go into the Europa League, there is a very real possibility of silverware on the line. And the one thing I want to ask you guys just quickly, because we always say we don't know whether it's, you know, fifth place will be enough. Is there a mathematical calculation we can make at this stage to know when, if fifth place will be good enough to get into the Champions League next season? I know it's all to do with how British clubs or certainly English clubs fare this season, but how complicated is the whole issue?
We won't know officially really until the end of the season, unless, I mean, it's effectively a league table. So, you know, unless England is far enough ahead, let's say before the final, that then we'll know, then fine. But actually the final sort of points tally won't be right until the end. And it's fairly simple, really. At the moment, England are actually third, you know, behind Italy and Germany in the coefficient table. You get two from here on in. You get 2 points for any win in any of the three European competitions. There's no more value for Champions League wins than there is for Conference League wins. You get an extra point for going through, I think. So effectively, you sort of get 3 points for going through a round. And it's very tight. Like Italy are top, I think, with something like 14 points. Germany got 13, and England are basically on 13 as well. So it's effectively going to come down to which of those three countries' clubs do better in these three European competitions from here on in. And I have to say, I think England can be pretty confident, because if you look, for example, in the Champions League, just a quick, you know, quick summary here, you're looking at sort of City, Arsenal versus what, Bayern? We think this Bayern team can go further than those two. I don't think so. Then for Italy, it's sort of Inter Milan maybe. In the Europa League, you've got Liverpool, who could very easily win it, you know, probably the outstanding favourites. For Germany, there's Bayer Leverkusen, who are so focused on the title, I think probably not. And Italy have got AC Milan and Roma. England have also got Brighton and West Ham in there, who could go pretty far. And then if you look at the Conference League, well, you've got Villa, who, you know, have got Unai Emery, who's, you know, basically the European gold man. So, you know, in Italy, have got Fiorentina. And Germany, I don't even see anyone in the kind of top six or seven club. So I basically think that England have got a really good chance. I mean, you don't know, But I think particularly Germany, to me, look like they're struggling to get into that top two. And you only have to finish in the top two. So of those three clubs who are kind of far ahead of the others, the top two out of those three will get an extra spot.
But the perversity of this whole situation is that I should not have been laughing my head off in the final minute of Arsenal's game at Porto last weekend. We do need, unfortunately, Arsenal and West Ham. We've got a tough one against Freiburg. We've got to get behind these clubs somehow, guys, haven't we? I mean, it's ridiculous.
And they really want Villa to go far, obviously, for two reasons. One, it kind of keeps them exhausted, and two, it keeps the coefficient points up.
Okay, well, that's very well explained. I'm delighted that you've made that as clear as crystal. What is going to decide Sunday's game? I think, having looked at the mass again and added in that Chelsea game, I think whoever wins on Sunday will finish fourth, so we won't have to focus on European coefficients. But Danny Boy, what's the key to Spurs getting 3 points at Villa Park?
I mean, I think based on the game in North London, it's taking their chances, right? I mean, Villa play this high line, which just suited Spurs down to the ground at home. That was the game where they kept getting behind Villa. They kept getting balls over the top and through, but they just couldn't finish their dinner. And, you know, that was, you know, one of the most frustrating, I think, points dropped and defeats of the Postecoglou era, really, because Spurs did play really well in that game, despite being pretty depleted. So I think it's being more clinical. I mean, obviously, we saw a bit of that again on Saturday with that Werner miss. I wonder if Johnston comes into the side. You know, his pace would be useful against the high line, and he's obviously got his confidence up, and then he replaces either Werner or Kulusevski, I guess. So, yeah, I mean, I think Spurs can definitely take heart from that game despite losing it, because they did really control the ball and create a lot. But Villa are a different beast at home. We know that. You know, they're such a good side. So, yeah, I mean, I almost feel like being away from home might suit Spurs, though. You know, they just haven't risen to expectations of playing in North London during this kind of little favourable run they've had. So, you know, being back on the road might not be such a bad thing. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I think generally playing a kind of more adventurous and kind of more ambitious, better team will suit Spurs. So, you know, I like to think we'll see an improved performance.
I was just looking back at Villa's recent home games, the ones they've lost, you know, Newcastle, Man United, Chelsea in the Cup, to see if there was anything you sort of gleaned from that. I mean, it seems like in all those games, the team that won scored early goals, so maybe that might be key. And Villa, for all the sort of acclaim that Martinez and Konsa and players like that have had this season, they have been pretty leaky at times. So definitely with the way Spurs play, you would expect goals going into this game. I know we've said that before, like when they played Man City and there weren't many, but I'd fancy that. Yeah, it seems like Villa either have a really fast start like they did against Forest, or can be affected by a quick one. So yeah, come out of the blocks, which, to be honest, we haven't seen too much of Tottenham recently. If anything, it's been the exact opposite, to the point where there have been times when you're half wondered about drawing a comparison to that sort of weird Conte run where they kept having terrible first halves and then trying to turn it around the second half. But actually, when you look at the results, despite losing to Wolves, they actually won most of their games recently. So it doesn't really matter how you do it. But yeah, if they could sort of buck that trend, which has been a bit alarming of late anyway, and get a fast start at Villa, that might really help them. But as I said before, it is key that they don't lose this match.
Yeah, I mean, the Werner one is really interesting to me. Like, in a way, this is sort of the ultimate leap of faith with Werner, because no team plays a more high line, fine margin defence than Villa. Every single ball over the top is, you know, really perfectly executed in terms of that offside line. And it's really not inconceivable to think that Werner's going to spring in behind two or three times, Sonny as well. And you just think, is he going to get another one of those kind of one-on-ones? Is he going to get two or three good opportunities to sort of square it across to Sonny for a tap-in? And I wonder, you know, with Johnston obviously doing so well at the weekend, I think it's a big decision for Postecoglou which front three he goes with, because this is the kind of game where it would be really tempting, I think, to go with Werner, because you think, he's got that speed in behind and he could easily break that trap. But then do you trust him? You know, do you trust him in those decisive moments? So I'll be fascinated to see what the team is. And I just think the key is keeping Watkins quiet. You know, it's an easy thing to say, but it's his importance to Villa, I think, now is almost comparable to what Kane has been for Spurs, you know. And if you can kind of shut him down, I mean, it's not just his goals, but his assists as well for Villa is extraordinary, you know. And I mean, I think he tends to kind of move through that kind of left-hand channel a bit more, you know, so that could bring him up against Romero, which would be a fascinating battle. But if they can keep Watkins quiet, not get wound up by Martinez's antics. And I agree with Tom, you know, just kind of see it out, because we saw how Villa really kind of, when they played City, for example, were just so, they just kind of suffocated them with their press and the way they played. I think if Spurs can kind of just dampen the atmosphere a bit, you know, which is a very un-Postecoglou way of going about things, but if they can kind of stick in the game and still be there in the second half, then I think they've got a good chance. I actually think they could actually still lose this game and still get in the top four. I still think there's a lot of road left. You know, I know 8 points looks like a lot, but they'll still have a game in hand, and 5 points isn't a huge amount when we look at Villa's fixtures. So I don't think it's a do or die match. It's a crucial game, no doubt about that. But I think there's still a lot of road left in the season.
I don't like the fact that you're disparaging my in-depth analysis. Do you want me to go through all those results again, including the one I forgot? No, it should be a fantastic match on Sunday. And just with regards to Timo Werner, if you're not going to trust him now, you never will. He scored. I'm just hoping that goal he finally got at the weekend will unlock something in his mind. And Sunday offers him so much. So fingers crossed. Thanks very much to Tom Barkley of The Sun, to Tom Allnut of The Times, and to Dan Kilpatrick of The Evening Standard. We will reconvene after that very important Villa match. But until then, as always, it is, come on, you Super Spurs.